And, despite the safety of the glove box, both physicians also wore full protective gear. The director removed the container, cradling it in both hands for the 3-meter walk to the work table. For experimental purposes, the aerosol can was of the type used for insect spray, the sort one can place on a floor, activate, and leave to fog a whole room. It had been fully disassembled, cleaned out 3 times with live steam, and put back together. The plastic parts had been a problem, but that had been figured out a few months earlier. It was a crude device. The production versions would be far more elegant. The only danger here was from the liquid nitrogen, a watery-appearing fluid which, if spilled on the gloves, would freeze them immediately, and soon thereafter cause them to fragment like black crystal glass. The director stood aside as Moody poured the cryogenic liquid around the pressure vessel. Only a few cc's were required for the purpose of the experiment. Next, the Ebola-rich liquid was injected into the stainless steel inner container, and the top screwed in place. When the cap was sealed, the new container was sprayed with disinfectant, then washed with sterile saline. The smaller transfer container went into a disposal bin for incineration. "There," the director said, "we are ready." Inside the spray can, the Ebola was already deep frozen, but not for long. The nitrogen would boil off relatively rapidly, and the sample would thaw. In that time, the rest of the experiment would be set up. And in that time, the 2 physicians would remove their protective clothing and have dinner. The colonel driving the airplane touched down with consummate skill. It was his first time flying this president, and he had something to prove. The rollout was routine, with the reverse thrusters slowing the jumbo to auto speed before the nose came around to the left. Out the windows, Ryan could see hundreds. No, he realized, thousands of people. "All there to see me," he wondered. "Damn." In their hands, dangling over the low perimeter fence, were the red, white, and blue colors of the national flag. And when the aircraft finally stopped, those flags came up at one time, as though in a wave. The mobile stairs came to the door, which was opened by the steward. To call her a stewardess would have been incorrect. Who'd given him a cigarette? "Want another one?" she whispered. Ryan grinned. "Maybe later. And thanks, Sarge. Break a leg, Mr. President. But not on the stairs, okay?" She got a chuckle as reward. "All ready for the boss?" Price heard over her radio circuit from the leader of the advance team. With that, she nodded at President Ryan. "Showtime, Mr. President." Ryan took a deep breath and stood in the center of the door, looking out into the bright Midwestern sunlight. The protocol was that he had to walk down first and alone. Barely had he stood in the opening when a cheer went up, and this from people who scarcely knew a thing about him. His coat buttoned, his hair combed down and sprayed into place despite his objections, Jack Ryan walked down the steps, feeling more like a fool than a president, until he got to the bottom. There an Air Force Chief Master Sergeant snapped a salute, which Ryan, so imprinted by his brief months in the Marine Corps, returned smartly, and another cheer went up. He looked around to see Secret Service and other Treasury agents deployed around, almost all of them looking outward. The first person to come close was the governor of the state. "Welcome to Indiana, Mr. President." He seized Ryan's hand and shook it vigorously. "We are honored to host your first official visit." They'd laid out everything for this one. A company of the local National Guard was formed up. The band crashed out, ruffles and flourishes, immediately followed by "Hail to the Chief," and Ryan felt himself to be a singular fraud. With the governor to his left and half a step behind, Ryan followed the red, what else, carpet. The assembled soldiers came to present arms, and their ancient regimental standard dipped, though not the stars and stripes, of course, which an American athlete had once proclaimed, "dips to no earthly king or potentate." He'd been an Irish-American, unwilling so to honor the King of England at the 1908 Olympiad. Jack moved his right hand over his heart as he passed, a gesture remembered from his youth, and looked at the assembled guardsmen. He was their commander-in-chief now, the president told himself. He could give orders sending them off to the field of battle, and he had to look at their faces. There they were, clean-shaven and young and proud, as he would have been 20-odd years earlier. They were here for him. And he always had to be there for them. Yeah, Jack told himself, have to remember that. "May I introduce you to some local citizens, sir?" the governor asked, pointing to the fence. Ryan nodded and followed. "Heads up, press and flesh," Andrea called over her radio microphone. For as many times as they'd seen it happen, the agents on presidential detail detested this above all things. Price would be with POTUS at all times. Raymond and three others hovered on both sides of him, their eyes scanning the crowd from behind dark sunglasses, looking for guns, for the wrong expression, for faces memorized from photographs, for anything out of the ordinary. There were so many of them, Jack thought. None of them had voted for him, and until very recently few had even known his name. Yet they were here. Some, perhaps, state government employees getting half a day off. But not the ones holding kids. Not all of them. And the looks in their eyes stunned the president, who'd never in his life experienced anything even close to this. Hands extended frantically, and he shook all that he could, moving to his left down the line, trying to hear individual voices through the cacophony of screams. "Welcome to Indiana! How are you? Mr. President! We trust you! Good job so far! We're with you!" Ryan tried to answer back, achieving little more than a repeated thank you, his mouth mainly open in surprise at the overpowering warmth of the moment, and all directed at him. It was enough to make him overlook the pain in his hand, but finally he had to step away from the fence and wave, to yet another roar of love for the new president. Damn, if they only knew what a fraud he was, Jack thought. What would they do then? What the hell am I doing here, his mind demanded, as he headed for the open door of the presidential limousine. There were 10 of them down in the basement of the building. All were men. Only one was a political prisoner, and his crime was apostasy. The rest were singularly undesirable people, 4 murderers, a rapist, 2 child molesters, and 2 thieves who were repeat offenders, and, under the Quranic law of their nation, subject to removal of their right hands. They were in a single climate-controlled room, each of them secured to the foot of the bed by leg cuffs. All were condemned to death, except the thieves who were only supposed to be mutilated, and knew it, and wondered why they were here with the rest. Why the others were still alive was a mystery to them, which none questioned, but from which none took satisfaction either. Their diet over the past weeks had been particularly poor, enough to reduce their physical energy and their level of alertness. One of their number stuck a finger in his mouth to feel his sore and bleeding gums. The finger came out when the door opened. It was someone in a blue plastic suit, which none of them had seen before. The person, a man, though they could barely make out the face through the plastic mask, set a cylindrical container down on the concrete floor, took off the blue plastic cap, and pressed down on a button. Then he hastily withdrew. Scarcely had the door closed when there came a hiss from the container, and a steam-like fog sprayed up into the room. One of their number screamed, thinking that it was a poison gas, seizing the thin bedsheet and clasping it over his face. The one closest to the spray was slower-witted and merely watched, and when the cloud came over him, he looked around at it while the others waited for him to die. When he didn't, they were more curious than fearful. After a few minutes, the incident passed into their limited history. The lights were turned off, and they went to sleep. 3 days to find out, the director said, turning off the TV that fed from the cell. The spray system appears to work well, proper dispersion. They had a problem with the delay device. On the production version, it has to be good for, what, 5 minutes, I think. 3 days, Moody thought. 72 hours to see what evil they had wrought. For all the money and hype, for all the exquisite planning, Ryan was sitting on a simple folding metal chair, the sort to make a person's rump sore. In front of him was a wooden rail covered with red, white, and blue bunting. Under the bunting was sheet steel supposed to stop a bullet. The podium was similarly armored, steel and Kevlar in this case. Kevlar is both stronger and lighter, and would protect nearly all of his body below the shoulders. The university fieldhouse, a very large gymnasium, though not the one used for the school's basketball team already eliminated in the NCAA tournament, was packed to the rafters, reporters would probably say, that being the stock phrase for a building with all its seats occupied. Most of the audience were probably students, but it was hard to tell. Ryan was the target of numerous bright lights, and the flood of brilliance denied him the ability to see most of the crowd. They'd arrived via the back door, walking through a smelly locker room because the president took the fast way in and out. The motorcade had come down a highway for most of the way, but in the regular city streets that had occupied maybe a quarter of the distance, there had been people on the sidewalks, waving to him while their governor extolled the virtues of the city and the Hoosier state. Jack had thought to ask the origin of Hoosier, but decided not to. The governor was talking again now, succeeding three others. A student, followed by the university president, followed by the mayor of the local town. The president actually tried listening to the speeches, but while on one hand they all said mainly the same thing, on the other little of it was true. It was as though they were speaking of someone else, a theoretical president with generic virtues to deal with the misstated duties. Maybe it was just that the local speechwriters dealt with local issues only, Jack decided. So much the better for them. "My great honor to introduce the President of the United States." The governor turned and gestured. Ryan rose, approached the podium, shook the governor's hand. As he set his speech folder on the top of the podium, he nodded embarrassed appreciation at the crowd he could barely see. In the first few rows, right on the hardwood of the basketball court, were local big shots. In other times and circumstances, they'd be major contributors. In this case, Ryan didn't know. Maybe from both parties, even. Then he remembered that major contributors donated money to both parties anyway, to hedge their bets by guaranteeing themselves access to power no matter who was there. They were probably already trying to figure how to donate money to his campaign. "Thank you, Governor, for that introduction." Ryan turned to gesture to the people on the dais with him, naming them from the list on the first page of his speech folder. Good friends whom he'd never see again after this first time, whose faces were illuminated by the simple fact that he spoke their names in the correct order. "Ladies and gentlemen, I've never been to Indiana before. This is my first visit to the Hoosier State. But after experiencing your welcome, I hope it won't be the last." It was as though someone had held up the applause sign on a TV show. He'd just spoken the truth, followed by something that might or might not have been a lie, and while they had to know it, they didn't care a whit. And then Jack Ryan learned something important for the first time. "God, it's like a narcotic," Jack thought, understanding just then why people entered politics. No man could stand here like this, hearing the noise, seeing the faces, and not love the moment. It came through the stage fright, through the overwhelming sense of not belonging. Here he was before 4,000 people, fellow citizens each of them, equal to him before the law. But in their minds he was something else entirely. He was the United States of America. He was their president. But more than that, he was the embodiment of their hopes, their desires, the image of their own nation. And because of that, they were willing to love someone they didn't know, to cheer his every word, to hope that for a brief moment they could believe that he'd looked directly into each individual pair of eyes, so that the moment would be forever special, never to be forgotten. It was power such as he had never known to exist. This crowd was his to command. This was why men devoted their lives to seeking the presidency, to bathe in this moment like a warm ocean wave, a moment of utter perfection. But why did they think he was so different? What made him special in their minds, Ryan wondered. It was only chance in his case, and in every other instance it was they who'd done the choosing, they who had elevated the man to the podium, they who by their act had changed the ordinary into something else. And, perhaps, not even that. It was only perception. Ryan was the same man he'd been a month or a year before. He'd acquired little in the way of new knowledge, and less in the way of wisdom. He was the same person with a different job, and while the trappings of the new post were all around him, the person within the protective ring of bodyguards, the person surrounded by a flood of love which he'd never sought, was merely the product of parents, a childhood, an education, and experiences, just as they all were. They thought him different and special, and perhaps even great, but that was perception, not reality. The reality of the moment was sweaty hands on the armored podium, a speech written by someone else, and a man who knew that he was out of place, however pleasant the moment might be. "So, what do I do now?" the President of the United States asked himself, his mind racing as the current wave of applause diminished. He'd never be what they thought he was. He was a good man, he thought, but not a great one, and the presidency was a job, a post, a government office that came with duties defined by James Madison, and, as with all things in life, a place of transition from one reality to another. The past was something you couldn't change. The future was something you tried to see. The present was where you were, and that's where you had to do your best. And if you were lucky, maybe you'd be worthy of the moment. It wasn't enough to feel the love. He had to earn it, to make the looks on the assembled faces something other than a lie. For in giving power, they also gave responsibility. And in giving love, they demanded devotion in return. Chastened, Jack looked at the glass panel that reflected the text of his speech, took a deep breath, and started talking as he'd done as a history instructor in Annapolis. "I come here today to speak to you about America." Below the president were five Secret Service agents standing in line, their sunglasses shielding their eyes so that those in the audience could not always tell where they were looking, and also because people without eyes are intimidating at a visceral level. Their hands were clasped in front, and radio earpieces kept them in contact with one another as they scanned the crowd. In the rear of the field house were others, this group scanning with binoculars, because they knew that the love in the building was not uniform, or even that there were some who sought to kill the things they loved. For that reason, the advance team had erected portable metal detector arches at all the entrances. For that reason, Belgian Malinois dogs had sniffed the building for explosives. For that reason, they watched everything in the same way an infantryman in a combat zone was careful to examine every shadow. "And the strength of America lies not in Washington, but in Indiana, and New Mexico, and in every place Americans live and work, wherever it might be. We in Washington are not America. You are," the president's voice boomed through the PA system. Not a good system, the agents thought, but this event had been laid on a little fast. "And we work for you." The audience cheered again anyway. The TV cameras all fed into vans outside the building, and those had uplink dishes to relay the sound and pictures to satellites. The reporters were mainly in the back today, taking notes despite the fact that they had the full text, along with a written promise that the president really would deliver this one. "The president's speech today," all would say this evening, but it wasn't really the president's speech at all. They knew who'd written it. Callie Weston had already talked to several of their number about it. They read the crowd, an easier task for them because they didn't have the Klieg lights in their faces. "Is not an opportunity, but a responsibility which we all share. Because if America belongs to us all, so then the duty for running our country starts here, not in Washington. More applause. Good speech, Tom Donner observed to his commentator analyst, John Plummer. Pretty good delivery, too. I talked to the superintendent of the Naval Academy. They say he was an excellent teacher once, Plummer replied. Good audience for him, mainly kids, and he's not talking major policy issues. Getting his feet wet, John agreed. You have a team working the other segment for tonight, right? Donner checked his watch and nodded. Should be there now. So, Dr. Ryan, how do you like being First Lady? Kristen Matthews asked, with a warm smile. I'm still figuring it out. They were talking in Kathy's cubbyhole office overlooking central Baltimore. It had barely enough room for a desk and three chairs, a good one for the doctor, one for the patient, and the other for the spouse or mother of the patient. And with all the cameras and lights in the room, she felt trapped. You know, I miss cooking for my family. You're a surgeon, and your husband expects you to cook, too? The NBC co-anchor asked, in surprise bordering on outrage. I've always loved cooking. It's a good way for me to relax when I get home. Instead of watching TV, Professor Carolyn Ryan didn't add. She was wearing a new starched lab coat. She'd had to take 15 minutes with her hair and makeup, and she had patients waiting. Besides, I'm pretty good at it. Ah, well, that was different. A cloying smile. What's the president's favorite meal? A smile returned. That's easy. Steak, baked potato, fresh corn on the cob, and my spinach salad. And I know the physician in me tells him that it's a little heavy on the cholesterol. Jack's pretty good with a grill. In fact, he's a pretty handy man to have around the house. He doesn't even mind cutting the grass. Let me take you back to the night your son was born. That awful night when the terrorists... I haven't forgotten, Kathy said in a quieter voice. Your husband has killed people. You're a doctor. How does that make you feel? Jack and Robbie, he's Admiral Jackson now. Robbie and Sissy are our closest friends, Kathy explained. Anyway, they did what they had to do, or we would not have survived that night. I don't like violence. I'm a surgeon. Last week I had a trauma case. A man lost his eye as a result of a fistfight in a bar a few blocks from here. But what Jack did is different from what they did. My husband fought to protect me and Sally, and little Jack, who wasn't even born yet. You like being a doctor? I love my work. I wouldn't leave it for anything. But usually a first lady... I know what you want to say. I'm not a political wife. I practice medicine. I'm a research scientist, and I work in the best eye institute in the world. I have patients waiting for me now. They need me. And you know I need them, too. My job is who I am. I'm also a wife and a mother, and I like nearly everything about my life. Except this? Kristen asked, with a smile. Kathy's blue eyes twinkled. I really don't have to answer that, do I? And Matthews knew she had the tagline for the interview. What sort of man is your husband? Well, I can't be totally objective, can I? I love him. He's risked his life for me and my children. Whenever I've needed him, he was there. And I do the same for him. That's what love and marriage mean. Jack is smart. He's honest. I guess he's something of a worrier. Sometimes he'll wake up in the middle of the night, at home, I mean, and spend half an hour looking out the windows at the water. I don't think he knows that I know that. Does he still do that? Not lately. He's pretty tired when he gets to bed. These are the worst hours he's ever worked. His other government posts, at CIA, for example, there are reports that he... Kathy stopped that one with a raised hand. I do not have a security clearance. I don't know, and probably I don't want to know. It's the same with me. I am not allowed to discuss confidential patient information with Jack or anyone else outside the faculty here. We'd like to see you with patients, and... Flotus shook her head, stopping the question dead. No, this is a hospital, not a TV studio. It's not so much my privacy as that of my patients. To them, I am not the First Lady. To them, I am Dr. Ryan. I'm not a celebrity. I'm a physician and a surgeon, To my students, I'm a professor and teacher. And reportedly one of the best in the world at what you do, Matthews added, just to see the reaction. A smile resulted. Yes, I've won the Lasker Prize, and the respect of my colleagues is a gift that's worth more than money. But you know that isn't it either. Sometimes, not very often, but sometimes after a major procedure, I'm the one who takes the bandages off in a darkened room, and we turn the lights up slowly, and I see it. I can see it on the patient's face. I fixed the eyes, and they work again, and the look you see on his or her face. Well, nobody's in medicine for the money, at least not here at Hopkins. We're here to make sick people well, and for me to preserve and restore sight. And the look you see when that job is done is like having God tap you on the shoulder and say, "Nice job." That's why I'll never, never leave medicine, Kathy Ryan said, almost lyrically, knowing that they'd use this on TV tonight, and hoping that maybe some bright, young high school kid would see her face and hear the words and decide to think about medicine. If she had to put up with this waste of her time, perhaps she could use it to serve her art. It was a pretty good sequence, Kristen Matthews thought, but with only 2 minutes and 30 seconds of airtime, they would not be able to use it. Better the part about how she hated being First Lady. Everybody was used to hearing doctors talk. Chapter 24. On the Fly. The return to the airplane was quick and efficient. The governor went his way. The people who'd lined the sidewalks were mainly back to their jobs, and those who turned and looked were shoppers who probably wondered what the sirens were all about, or if they knew were annoyed with the noise. Ryan was able to lean back in the plush leather seats, deflated by the fatigue that comes after a stressful moment. "So, how'd I do?" he asked, looking out the window as Indiana passed by at 70 miles per hour. He smiled inwardly at the thought of driving this fast in the outskirts of a city without getting a ticket. "Very well, actually," Callie Weston said first. "You talked like a teacher."
"I was a teacher once," the president said. "And with luck, I may be again some day."
"Well, that's okay for a speech like this, but for others you'll need a little fire," Arnie observed. "One thing at a time," Callie advised the chief of staff. "You crawl before you walk."
"Same speech in Oklahoma, right?" POTUS asked.
"A few changes, but no big deal. Just remember you're not in Indiana anymore. Sooner State, not Hoosier State. Same line about tornadoes, but football instead of basketball."
"They also lost both senators, but they still have a congressman left, and he'll be on the dais with you," Van Damme advised.
"How'd he make it?" Jack asked idly.
"Probably getting laid that night," was the curt answer.
"You'll announce a new contract for Tinker Air Force Base. It means about 500 new jobs, consolidating a few operations at the new location. That'll make the local papers happy."
Ben Goodley didn't know if he was the new National Security Advisor or not. If so, he was rather young for the job, but at least the president he served was well grounded in foreign affairs. That made him more a high-class secretary than an advisor. It was a function he didn't mind. He'd learned much in his brief time at Langley, and had advanced rapidly, becoming one of the youngest men ever to win the coveted NIO card because he knew how to organize information, and because he had the political savvy to grade the important stuff. He especially liked working directly for President Ryan. Goodley knew that he could play it straight with the boss, and that Jack—he still thought of him by that name— though he could no longer use it, would always let him know what he was thinking. It would be another learning experience for Dr. Goodley, and a priceless one for someone whose new life dream was someday becoming DCI on merit and not through politics. On the wall opposite his desk was the sort of clock that shows the sun position for the entire world. He'd ordered it the very day he'd arrived, and, to his surprise, it had appeared literally overnight, instead of perking its way through 5 levels of procurement bureaucracy. He'd heard stories that the White House was one portion of the government that actually did work, and had not believed them.
The Harvard graduate had been in government service about 4 years now, and figured he knew what worked and what didn't.
The surprise was welcome, and the clock he'd found from his work in the CIA Operations Center was an instant reference, better than the array of regular clocks that some places had. Your eye instantly saw where noon was, and could automatically grasp what time it was anywhere in the world. More to the point, you instantly knew if something was happening at an unusual hour, and that told you as much as the Signals Intelligence SIGINT bulletin, such as the one that had just come in over his personal fax machine that was connected to his STU-4 secure phone. The National Security Agency was in the habit of posting periodic summaries of activity across the world. Its own watch center was staffed by senior military people, and while their outlook was more technical and less political than his own, they were not fools. Ben had gotten to know many of them by name in addition to reputation, and had also learned their individual strengths. The U.S. Air Force colonel, who had command of the NSA Watch Center on weekday afternoons, didn't bother people with trivia. That was left to lower-level people and lower-level signals. When the colonel put his name on something, it was usually worth reading. And so it was just after noon, Washington time. Goodley saw that the flash concerned Iraq. That was another thing about the colonel. He didn't go using critic headers for the fun of it, as some did. Ben looked up to check the wall clock. After sundown, local time, a time of relaxation for some, and action for others. The action would be the sort to last all night, the better to get things accomplished without interference, so that the next day would be genuinely new and genuinely different. "Oh, boy," Goodley breathed. He read down the page again, then turned his swivel chair and picked up the phone, touching the number 3 speed dial button. "Director's office," a 50-ish female voice answered. "Goodley for Foley." "Please hold, Dr. Goodley." Then, "Hi, Ben." "Hello, Director." He felt it improper to first name the DCI. He'd probably go back to work at Langley within the year, and not as a 7th-floor rank official. "You have what I have?" The page was still warm in his hand from the printer. "Iraq?" "Right." "You must have read it twice, Ben. I just told Bert Vasco to get his ass up here." CIA's own Iraq desk was weak, both thought, while this state guy was very good indeed. "Looks pretty hot to me." "Agreed," Ed Foley replied, with an unseen nod. "Jesus, but they're moving fast over there. Give me an hour, maybe 90 minutes. "I think the president needs to know," Goodley said, with a voice that concealed the urgency he felt. Or so he thought. "He needs to know more than we can tell him now. Ben," the DCI added.
"Yes, Director."
"Jack won't kill you for patience, and we can't do any more than watch it develop anyway. Remember, we can't overload him with information. He doesn't have the time to see it all anymore. What he sees has to be concise." "That's your job," Ed Foley explained. "It'll take you a few weeks to figure it out." "I'll help," the DCI went on, reminding Goodley how junior he was.
"Okay, I'll be waiting."
The line clicked off. Goodley had about a minute during which he reread the NSA bulletin, and then the phone rang again.
"Dr. Goodley?"
"Doctor, this is the president's office," one of the senior secretaries said. "I have a Mr. Golovko on the president's private line. Can you take the call?"
"Yes," he said, thinking, "Oh, shit."
"Go ahead, please," she said, clicking off the line. "This is Ben Goodley."
"This is Golovko. Who are you?"
"I am acting National Security Advisor to the President."
"And I know who you are."
"Goodley?"
Ben could hear the voice searching his memory.
Ah, yes, you are a National Intelligence Officer who just learned to shave. My congratulations on your promotion.
The gamesmanship was impressive, though Goodley figured that there was a file on the Russian's desk with everything down to his shoe size. Even Golovko's memory wouldn't be that good, and Goodley had been in the White House long enough that the word would have gotten out, and the RVS KGB would have done its homework. Well, somebody has to answer the phones, Minister. Gamesmanship could go two ways. Golovko wasn't really a minister, though he acted as such, and that was technically a secret. It was a weak reply, but it was something. What can I do for you?
You know the arrangement I have with Ivan Emetovich?
Yes, sir, I do.
Very well. Tell him that a new country is about to be born. It will be called the United Islamic Republic. It will include, for the moment, Iran and Iraq. I rather suspect that it will wish to grow further.
How reliable is that information, sir?
Better to be polite. It would make the Russian feel bigger. Young man, I would not make a report to your president unless I felt it to be reliable, but, he added generously, I understand you must ask the question. The point of origin for the report does not concern you. The reliability of the source is sufficient for me to pass the information along with my own confidence. There will be more to follow. Do you have similar indications?
The question froze Goodley's eyeballs in place, staring down at a blank spot on his desk. He had no guidance on this. Yes, he'd learned that President Ryan had discussed cooperation with Golovko, that he'd also discussed the matter with Ed Foley, and that both had decided to go forward with it. But nobody had told him the parameters for giving information back to Moscow, and he didn't have time to call Langley for instructions, else he would appear weak to the Russians. And the Russians didn't want America to appear weak at the moment, and he was the man on the spot, and he had to make a decision. That entire thought process required about a third of a second.
Yes, Minister, we do. Your timing is excellent. Director Foley and I were just discussing the development.
Ah, yes, Dr. Goodley, I see that your signals people are as efficient as ever. What a pity that your human sources do not match their performance.
Ben didn't dare to respond at all to the observation, though its accuracy caused his stomach to contract. Goodley had more respect for Jack Ryan than he did for any man, and now he remembered the admiration Jack had often expressed for the man on the other end of the phone. Welcome to the bigs, kid. Don't hang any curveballs. He ought to have said that Foley had called him.
Minister, I will be speaking to President Ryan within the hour, and I will pass your information along. Thank you for your timely call, sir.
Good day, Dr. Goodley.
United Islamic Republic, Ben read on his desk pad. There had once been a United Arab Republic, an unlikely alliance between Syria and Egypt doomed to failure in two respects. The separated countries had been fundamentally incompatible, and the alliance had been made only to destroy Israel, which had objected to the goal, and done so effectively. More to the point, a United Islamic Republic was a religious statement as much as a political one, because Iran was not an Arab nation, as Iraq was, but rather an Aryan one with different ethnic and linguistic roots. Islam was the world's only major religion to condemn in its scripture all forms of racism and proclaim the equality of all men before God, regardless of color, a fact often overlooked by the West. So Islam was overtly designed to be a unifying force, and this new notional country would play on that fact with its very name. That said a lot, enough that Golovko didn't even need to explain it. And it also said that Golovko felt that he and Ryan were on the same wavelength. Goodley checked the wall clock again. It was nighttime in Moscow, too. Golovko was working late. Well, not all that late for a senior official. Ben lifted the phone and hit number 3 again. It took him less than a minute to summarize the call from Moscow.
"We can believe anything he says, on this issue anyway. Sergei Nikolaevich is a pro from way back. I imagine he twisted your tail just a little, right?" the DCI asked.
"Ruffled the fur some," Goodley admitted.
"It's a carryover from old days. They do like their status games. Don't let it bother you, and don't shoot back. Better just to ignore it," Foley explained.
"Okay, what's he worried about?"
"A lot of republics with Stan at the end," Goodley blurted out without thinking.
"Concur." This came from another voice.
"Vasco?"
"Yeah, just walked in."
And then Goodley had to repeat what he'd told Ed Foley. Probably Mary Pat was there, too. Individually, both were good at what they did. In the same room, thinking together, they were a deadly weapon. It was something you had to see to understand, Ben knew.
"This looks to me like a big deal," Goodley observed.
"Looks that way to me, too," Vasco said over the speakerphone. "Let us kick a few things around. Be back to you in 15 or 20.
"Would you believe Avi Ben-Yakob is checking in with us?" Ed reported, after a background noise on the line. "They must be having a really tough day." For the moment, it was just irony that the Russians were both the first to check in with America, and that they were doing so at all, and that they were the only ones calling straight into the White House, beating the Israelis on both scores. But the amusement wouldn't last, and all the players knew that. Israel was probably having the worst day of all. Russia was merely having a very bad one. And America was getting to share the experience. It would have been uncivilized to deny them a chance at prayer. Cruel though they were, and criminals though they had been, they had to have their chance at prayer, albeit a brief one. Each was in the presence of a learned mullah, who, with firm but not unkind voice, told them of their fates, and cited scripture, and spoke to them of their chance to reconcile with Allah before meeting him face to face. Everyone did. Whether they believed in what they did was another issue, and one left for Allah to judge, but the mullahs had done their duty. And then everyone was led out into the prison yard. It was a sort of assembly line process, carefully timed, so that the 3 clergymen gave each condemned criminal exactly 3 times the interval required to take each out in his turn, tie him to the post, shoot him, remove the body, and restart the process. It worked out to 5 minutes per execution and 15 minutes for prayer. The commanding general of the 41st Armored Division was typical, except that his religion was something more than vestigial. His hands were bound in his cell before his imam. The general preferred the Arabic term to the Farsi one. And he was led out by soldiers who, a week before, would have saluted and trembled at his passage. He'd reconciled himself to his fate, and he would not give the Persian bastards he'd fought in the border swamps the least bit of satisfaction. Though inwardly, he cursed to God the cowardly superiors who had skipped the country and left him behind. Perhaps he might have killed the president himself and taken over, he thought, as his handcuffs were looped to the post. The general took a moment to look back at the wall to gauge how good was the marksmanship of the firing squad. He found strange humor in the fact that it might take him a few extra seconds to die, and he snorted in disgust. Russian-trained and competent, he'd tried to be an honest soldier, non-political, following his orders faithfully and without question, whatever they might be, and therefore had never been fully trusted by his country's political leadership, and this was his reward for it. A captain came up with a blindfold. "A cigarette, if you please. You may keep that for when you sleep later tonight."
The captain nodded without expression, his emotions already numbed by the 10 killings done in the past hour. Shaking a cigarette from his pack, he put it into the man's lips and lit it with a match. That done, he said what he felt he must.
"Salam alaikum. Peace be unto you." I will have more than you, young man. Do your duty. Make sure your pistol is loaded, will you?"
The general closed his eyes for a long, pleasurable puff. His doctor had told him only a few days before that it was bad for his health. Wasn't that a joke? He looked back on his career, marveling that he was still alive after what the Americans had done to his division in 1991. Well, he'd avoided death more than once, and that was a race a man could lengthen but never win, not really. And so it was written. He managed another long puff. An American Winston. He recognized the taste. How did a mere captain ever get a pack of those? The soldiers brought their rifles up to aim. There was no expression on their faces. Well, killing did that to men, he reflected. What was supposed to be cruel and horrible just became a job that... The captain came over to the body that was slumped forward, suspended by the nylon rope that looped around the handcuffs. Again, he thought, drawing his 9mm Browning and aiming from a meter away. A final crack put an end to the groans. Then two soldiers cut the rope and dragged the body off. Another soldier replaced the rope on the post. A fourth used a gardener's rake to move the dirt around, not so much to conceal the blood as to mix dirt with it, because blood was slippery to walk on. The next one would be a politician, not a soldier. The soldiers at least died with dignity for the most part, as the last one had. Not the civilians. They whimpered and wept and cried out to Allah. And they always wanted the blindfold. It was something of a learning experience for the captain, who'd never done anything like this before. It had taken a few days to get things organized, but they were all now in separate houses in separate parts of town. And once that had been accomplished, the generals and their entourages had started worrying about it. Separately quartered, they'd all thought, they could be picked up one by one and jailed preparatory to a return flight to Baghdad. But it wouldn't really have mattered very much. None of the families had more than two bodyguards, and what could they do, really, except to keep beggars away when they went outside? They met frequently. Every general had a car assigned, mainly with the purpose of making further travel arrangements. They also bickered over whether they should continue to travel together to a new collective home, or begin to go their separate ways. Some argued that it would be both more secure and more cost-effective to buy a large piece of land and build on it, for example. Others were making it clear that now that they were out of Iraq once and for all, two of them had illusions about going back in triumph to reclaim the government, but that was fantasy, as all but those two knew. They would be just as happy not to see some of their number ever again. The petty rivalries among them had long concealed genuine antipathy, which their new circumstances didn't so much exacerbate as liberate. The least of them had personal fortunes of over $40 million. One had nearly $300 million salted away in various Swiss banks, more than enough to live a comfortable life in any country in the world. Most chose Switzerland, always a haven to those with money and a desire to live quietly, though a few looked farther to the east. The Sultan of Brunei wanted some people to reorganize his army, and three of the Iraqi generals thought to apply for the job. The local Sudanese government had also begun informal discussions about using a few as advisers for ongoing military operations against animist minorities in the southern part of that country. The Iraqis had long experience dealing with Kurds. But the generals had more to worry about than themselves alone. All had brought their families out. Many had brought mistresses, who now lived, to everyone's discomfort, in the homes of their patrons. These were as ignored now as they had been in Baghdad. That would change. Sudan is mostly a desert country, known for its blistering dry heat. Once a British protectorate,
Its capital has a hospital catering to foreigners, with a largely English staff. Not the world's best facility, it was better than most in Saharan Africa, staffed mostly with young and somewhat idealistic physicians who'd arrived with romantic ideas about both Africa and their careers. The same thing had been going on for over 100 years. They learned better, but they did their best, and that, for the most part, was pretty good. The two patients arrived scarcely an hour apart. The young girl came in first, accompanied by her worried mother. She was 4 years old, Dr. Ian McGregor learned, and had been a healthy child, except for a mild case of asthma, which, the mother correctly said, ought not to have been a problem in Khartoum with its dry air. Where were they from? Iraq? The doctor neither knew nor cared about politics. He was 28, newly certified for internal medicine, a small man with prematurely receding sandy hair. What mattered was that he'd seen no bulletin concerning that country and a major infectious disease. He and his staff had been alerted about the Ebola blip in Zaire, but it had been only a blip. The patient's temperature was 38.0, hardly an alarming fever for a child, all the more so in a country where the noon temperature was always at least that high. Blood pressure, heart rate, and respiration were unremarkable. She appeared listless. "How long in Khartoum, did you say? Only a few days?" Well, it could be merely jet lag. Some people were more sensitive to it than others, McGregor explained. New surroundings and so forth could make a child out of sorts. Maybe a cold or the flu. Nothing serious. Sudan has a hot climate, but really a fairly healthy one, you see, not like other parts of Africa. He slipped his hands into rubber gloves, not for any particular need, but because his medical training at the University of Edinburgh had drilled it into him that you did it the same way every time, because the one time you forgot, you might end up like Dr. Sinclair. Oh, didn't you hear how he caught AIDS from a patient? One such story was generally enough. The patient was not in great distress, eyes a little puffy, throat slightly inflamed, but nothing serious. Probably a good night's sleep or two. Nothing to be prescribed. Aspirin for the fever and aches, and if the problem persists, please call me. She's a lovely child. I'm sure she'll be fine. Mother took child away. The doctor decided it was time for a cup of tea. Along the way to the doctor's lounge, he stripped off the latex gloves which had saved his life and dropped them in the disposal bin. The other came in 30 minutes later. Male, 33, looking rather like a thug, surly and suspicious toward the African staff, but solicitous to the Europeans. Obviously a man who knew Africa, McGregor thought. Probably an Arab businessman. "Do you travel a great deal?" "Recently." "Oh, well, that could be it. You want to be careful drinking the local water. That could explain the stomach discomfort." And he, too, went home with a bottle of aspirin, plus an over-the-counter medication for his GI problems, and presently McGregor went off duty after one more routine day. "Mr. President, Ben Goodley coming through on the stew," a sergeant told him. Then she showed him how the phones worked up front. "Yeah, Ben," Jack said. "We have reports of a lot of Iraqi big shots getting put up against the wall. I'm faxing the report down to you. The Russians and the Israelis both confirm." And on cue, another Air Force NCO appeared and handed Ryan 3 sheets of paper. The first one merely said, "Top Secret, President's Eyes Only," even though 3 or 4 communications types had seen it, and that was just in the airplane, now beginning its descent into Tinker. "Got it now. Let me read it." He took his time, first scanning the report, then going back to the beginning for a slower read. "Okay, who's going to be left?" "Vasco says nobody worth mentioning. This is the entire Ba'ath Party leadership and all the remaining senior military commanders.
That leaves nobody with status behind. Okay, the scary part comes from Palm Bowl, and... Who's this Major Sabah?
I called on that myself, sir, Goodley replied. He's a Kuwaiti spook. Our people say he's pretty swift. Vasco concurs in his assessment. It's going down the track we were afraid of, and it's going real fast.
Saudi response?
Ryan was jolted by a minor bump as the VC-25A came through some clouds. It looked to be raining outside.
None yet. They're still talking things over.
Okay, thanks for the heads up, Ben. Keep me posted.
Will do, sir.
Ryan put the phone back in its cradle and frowned.
Trouble? Arnie asked.
Iraq, it's going fast. They're executing people at a brisk clip at the moment.
The president handed the pages over to his chief of staff. There was always a huge sense of unreality to it. The NSA report, as amended and augmented by CIA and others, gave a list of men. Had he been in his office, Ryan would also have looked at photos of men he'd never met, and now never would. Because while he was descending into Oklahoma to give a non-political, political speech, the lives of the men on that list were ending. More likely, already had.
It was rather like listening to a ball game on the radio. Except in this game, real people were being shot. Reality was coming to an end for human beings 7,000 miles away, and Ryan was hearing about it from radio intercepts made even farther away and relayed to him. And it was real, but at the same time not real. There was just something about distance which did that, and his surroundings. 100 or so senior Iraqi officials are being shot. Want a sandwich before you get off the airplane? The dualism might have been amusing except for the foreign policy implications. No, that wasn't true either. There wasn't anything funny about it at all.
What are you thinking? Van Damme asked.
I ought to be back at the office, Ryan replied. This is important, and I need to keep track of it.
Wrong, Arnie said at once with a shake of the head and a pointing finger. You are not the National Security Advisor anymore. You have people to do that for you. You're the President, and you have a lot of things to do, and they're all important. The President never gets tied down on one issue, and he never gets trapped in the Oval Office. The people out there don't want to see that. It means you're not in control. It means events are controlling you. Ask Jimmy Carter how great his second term was. Hell, this isn't all that important.
It could be, Jack protested, as the aircraft touched down.
What's important right now is your speech for the Sooner State.
He paused before going on.
It isn't just charity that begins at home. It's political power, too. It starts right out there.
He pointed out the windows as Oklahoma slowed to a halt outside. Ryan looked, but what he saw was the United Islamic Republic. It had once been hard to enter the Soviet Union. There had been a vast organization called the Chief Border Guards Directorate of the Committee for State Security, which had patrolled the fences. In some cases, minefields and genuine fortifications as well, with the dual purpose of keeping people both in and out. But these had long since fallen into disrepair. And the main purpose of the border checkpoints today was for the new crop of regional border guards to accept the bribes that came from smugglers, who now used large trucks to bring their wares into the nation that had once been ruled with an iron hand in Moscow, but was now a collection of semi-independent republics that were mostly on their own in economic, and because of that, political terms as well. It hadn't been planned that way. When he'd established the country's central planned economy, Stalin had made a deliberate effort to spread out production sites, so that each segment of the vast empire would depend for vital commodities upon every other. But he'd overlooked the discordant fact that if the entire economy went to pot, then needing something you couldn't get from one source meant that you had to get it from another. And with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, smuggling, which had been well controlled under communist rule, had become a genuine industry of its own.
and with wares also came ideas, hard enough to stop and impossible to tax. The only thing lacking was a welcoming committee,